Hello, and thanks for tuning in to the 10th and Broad Church of Christ podcast. Today's message comes from Greg McAdams, guest speaker and elder at the 10th and Broad Church. Let's tune in now for Greg's message.
I've told y'all a little bit in the past about my, just a little bit about where I grew up. My dad worked for Exxon, so we spent a ton of time in South Louisiana. Predominantly Catholic area, churches of Christ were very small. It was a challenge to be a Christian youngster there. But I was blessed in a lot of ways. I really was. I pulled up a picture of young Greg here. If you've been on Facebook this week, you probably saw it because I was trying to find this picture. I don't know why moms thought sailor suits were natural for 6-year-olds, but it was, my dad had a good job. My mom was able to stay at home. We had what we needed. Didn't always have what we wanted, but we had what we needed. A lot of times we had what we wanted. And we were, from the time my dad got baptized, probably in about 62, 63, when I was about 2 years old. From then on, we were at the church every single time the doors opened. We were there. And because of that, I got to listen to great Bible teachers and preachers, and my dad taught me at home, and it was just a good life. It was a good life, and I was blessed to have two sets of grandparents. One set that lived fairly close in a place called Houma, and the other set that lived over in Mississippi for a while at Laurel, Mississippi, and then later on in Dadeville. They didn't live in Bogalusa, but the story comes from this little town. When we would leave Morgan City or Lafayette or late in the afternoon, we usually, being young boys, my brother was 3 years older than me, my mom tried to find ways to keep us busy. And so usually by the time we'd been driving 2 hours, we had played that game where you do all the license plates of every, trying to find all 50 license plates or more. You know, down here you can sometimes see some Mexican license plates as well. And then we'd also gone through the, as long as we could see, we'd gone through the ABC game. Did y'all used to play that where you go on the, you look for signs and you do ABC all the way through? But usually within 2 hours, because we were traveling at night, we were asleep. And I think that was my dad's motivation with that, was to get two boys to be quiet and to sleep. But as we traveled, it was inevitable, if we were going to Laurel especially, that sometime while I was sleeping, I was going to be woken up. And when I was woken up, it was going to be because of a very, very, very strong smell. The town of Bogalusa, that little dot you see on this map up here, I didn't know what the smell was at the time, but they had a paper mill. Have you ever gone through a town that has a paper mill? It is sour and tough smelling. And at a young age, I found out one of the smells that I really don't like. I don't like the smell of a paper mill. It would wake me up every time. And maybe I started to learn a little bit of the power of smell. The smell has a pretty strong power. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. I want you to think for just a minute, just in your head, some of your least favorite smells. And I'm going to put up a couple and see if this matches you. A smell that can be overpowering would be the smell of like onions or garlic and although they sound really good, they smell really good when they're cooking. Sometimes they don't smell so good when they're raw. Another bad smell, at least for me, is a wet, stinky dog. You ever have a dog that comes in from outside and that smell is just, it's repelling? Another smell, Robin would testify to this one probably. My dad could take his boots off at the end of the day and clear the house, right? It's not a good smell. And then for those of you that are connoisseurs of good food, they tell you that cheeses all smell good, but there are some cheeses that smell pretty bad. All of those are smells that sort of repel, that drive you away from them. But there are also, from my childhood memories, I can remember some good smells. And one of the smells that I remember is that, I went to this kindergarten that was right behind the Church of Christ in Lafayette, Louisiana. And a challenge for kids to take them somewhere, a good field trip. Really one of the only places they could take in town was the Wholesome Bakery, where they bake bread. And I remember going there at least two or three times before I got out of second grade. We had gone to the Wholesome Bakery. I discovered very quickly, the first time I got to the Wholesome Bakery, that one of my greatest smells that I love the most is baking bread. And they would tart you there. You had to go through the whole plant watching all these little loaves of bread go up the conveyor belt and bake. And at the very end, they would give you a little tiny loaf of Wholesome bread. And I wouldn't want to eat it because I'd want to smell it. And I'd take it home and I'd smell it for a while. And eventually I'd eat it, but it was a smell I grew to love. So along with bad smells, smells can have a strong power in how they draw you to them. And so I was thinking of a few of my favorite smells, and maybe these can relate to you as well. How many of you like the smell of bacon cooking? Raise your hand if you like the smell of bacon. Great way to wake up, right? What about the smell of a rose? Good? Okay. Another good smell. This is another one of my favorites, chocolate chip cookies. And I apologize, but you're going to see a trend here of good smells. They tend to go into food, and that's... looking at my size, you can see why I would pick those. Coffee. How many of you like that smell of that first cup of coffee? I loved it when we used to have the old percolators that perked all the time, and you could smell that coffee just going through the house. What about fresh cut grass? Any of you guys play baseball or football or softball for the girls, and you remember that smell of that fresh cut grass, and it reminded you it was baseball season? Or what about meat cooking? Grilling over maybe some mesquite and that smell's just wafting out. Aren't there places that use smells to try to sell you their food? And I was thinking about the guy who started Chick-fil-A. You know, when Chick-fil-A started, very quickly Kathy. Trick Kathy, I believe. Kathy, is that right? Anyway, he wanted to go into malls and he wanted people to buy his food. And he was smart enough to realize that if he had the exhaust from his fryers going out into the mall, that people would be drawn in. And I don't know if it's ever happened to you, but I've walked into a mall before not even having any plans of eating. And the Chick-fil-A smell hit me. And I was going down there hoping first that they were giving out samples. But if not, I was going to have to buy some. Anyway, today I would like for us to talk a little bit about smells that repel and smells that make us drawn to things. And if I can apologize to you, it has been a while since I preached, so if I'm a little bit off, I'm sorry about that. All right, so with all the ideas of the smells, I want us to look a little bit at Scripture this morning. If you got your Bible and you want to open it, that's fine. But we'll read it off the screen. This is from 2 Corinthians 2, 14 through 16. But thanks be to God who leads us as captives in Christ's triumphal procession and uses us to spread the aroma of the knowledge of Him everywhere. For we are to God the pleasing aroma of Christ among those who are being saved and to one we are an aroma that brings death, and to the other an aroma that brings life. And who is equal to such a task? So my question this morning is, what is the aroma of Christ? If the aroma of Christ is something that draws people in, if it's something that gives people the hope of life, what is the aroma of Christ? My take on it as I read the Bible, my feelings about Jesus as I read about Him, is the smell of Jesus was love. And it wasn't love maybe like we think of love sometimes. It has, I'll love you if you're like me. I love you if you do something for me. I love you because you're part of my family. This was love because He loved all mankind because His Father had made all mankind. And He had been sent to lead mankind towards God. I want us to look at three straight examples of Christ's aroma this morning from the New Testament, mainly using one story, but a couple of other stories in it. So if you want to follow along, we're going to talk first about Christ following meeting physical needs. I found out in life that very few people want to listen to you if something's bugging them real bad. Because of the time period there was, there were a lot of people in Christ's time that had needs. that were hungry because they had been forgotten, that they had been pushed to the side and weren't getting the things that they needed just to survive. And Jesus addressed those, and he almost always addressed them right off the bat. If you look at Matthew 14, starting with verse 13 and following, Jesus has just been told about the murder of his cousin, one of his closest friends, John the Baptist, the man who's very shortly before in this baptized Jesus. And so in his grief, he wants to go off by himself for a little while. And so he and the disciples head off out into the sort of the wilderness area to spend some time grieving, really. A very large crowd follows him. By this point in Jesus' ministry, people know something's different about him. He's not preaching the same message that the Jewish rabbis had taught. He's not preaching that idea that there was one group better than everybody else. He's teaching that God created all, and that God wants all men to be in heaven with him someday. Around dark, after he has been ministering to the crowd and teaching them, it gets to be around supper time. And they're out in the middle of the, way away from any major town apparently. And the disciples say, well, why don't we just let these guys go? I mean, we've taught them all day. They're hungry. Let's send them on into the little towns around here and see if they can find some food. And Jesus shows that love by saying, no, we don't need to do that. We don't need to do that. Go out and see what they've got. They come back and they've collected, I think in this particular, in Matthew's account, he says five loaves of bread and two fishes. And with that, Jesus feeds 5,000 people and has enough to pick up extra. I have this feeling he probably sent some of that extra stuff home with people that really needed it. A little bit after that, he meets the disciples' needs in the middle of a storm. They take off after the crowd's fed, and they're out in the middle of the lake. And Jesus is on shore, and the boat gets caught up in a big storm. And Jesus walks out to him, and he calms the storm. And he works on Peter's faith at the same time and lets Peter see maybe his faith isn't as strong as he thought it was. And if we go on a little bit later into Matthew 15, looking at about 29 and on, we see another crowd that's gathered. This time there's 4,000 people. And once again, these people have lots of needs. There's some in the crowd that are sick. There's some in the crowd that are needy for other things. Some of them, no doubt, possessed by demons, as that was a big problem during that time period. And very hungry people. And so in showing love, Jesus not only heals the sick, but he gives the blind their sight. And then he repeats the miracle that he had done before, this time feeding 4,000 people with what Mark says is seven loaves and a few small fish. It would not have been wrong for Jesus to agree with his followers and on both occasions send people off to get food. It wouldn't have been wrong at all, but he couldn't do that. He knew he had the capability to feed right here and to meet their needs, and the teaching could still go on while that was going on. If Jesus was going to speak of the kingdom, he wanted to make sure his audience didn't have groaning stomachs, worries about their kids starving to death, or anything that was going to keep their minds off the message that he was going to teach. And then we see in Matthew 8, another chance of Jesus meeting needs. Once again, same thing. There are people that need, and he meets them, and he gets them what they need. Let's open something real quick. A second thing that Jesus did, besides meeting physical needs, is he also taught the kingdom. How many opportunities a day do you get a chance to tell somebody about Jesus? And maybe don't. I'm gonna confess, too many, to stand in a public school classroom and to know that I have the key to what they need, to what so many of their families are struggling, looking for, and making big mistakes. And not to be able to share that openly is hard. It's hard. So I find ways to do it without it being quite so in their face. In Mark 6, Jesus uses this situation to teach a lesson not only to the people that are listening, but also to his disciples as well. And anytime you see in the New Testament when Jesus' life is being described in the Gospels, he is teaching. It might be something as simple as a parable, or it might be a direct lesson. But he's teaching from the time he starts with his disciples all the way to the last afternoon of his life. And then number three, Jesus befriended the friendless. And you could also put along with this one, Jesus gave worth to people that the society said had no worth. Now you can look at many instances in the New Testament where Jesus reaches out to people that everybody else would have pretty much given up on. In Matthew 8, early in the chapter, Jesus is selecting his disciples. You know, if I'm choosing disciples, if I'm choosing the 12 guys that are going to be responsible for taking the message to the world, I'm probably not looking for fishermen. I'm probably not looking for tax collectors because of the way that people feel about tax collectors. But yet Jesus picks people that the rest of the world would have said, nah, these guys can't teach. These guys can't preach. And he uses them to share the message that we still share today. Verse 1 of Matthew 8, one of the people that has sort of been shunned by society, the lepers, one leper comes up to him and he kneels in front of Jesus and he shows his faith when he says, I know you can take this away. And I love this story because Jesus could have very easily just said, you're right, you're healed, go on in your way. But he doesn't do that. What's he do? Do you remember? Anybody remember what he does? What's he do? Very close. Hey, what does he do? What does Jesus do to the leper before he heals him? He touches him. Nobody touched lepers. Nobody touched them. They were sent outside of town to their own area. If they were walking in areas where there were people that didn't have leprosy, they were supposed to ring a bell and say, unclean, unclean, unclean. Nobody would touch a leper. I have no idea how long it had been since he had been touched, but when Jesus touched him, that was better, I think, than the healing. It was great that he didn't have leprosy anymore. But he had been told by that touch that he was somebody who was worthy. Guys, we have people in this town who don't think they're worthy. We have people that are forgotten. I've had the great pleasure this summer of being able to observe Danny and Jimmy and several other guys, Rocky and some others, who come here every Thursday and who serve the poor. And we have quite a few people who come in from the area that if they're not homeless, they're right next to homeless. They're renting a hotel room for a very small amount of time. But most of those people, through things that have happened because of their decisions, and sometimes not their decisions, have been pretty much spurned by society. And I, once again, I'm going to confess, and I hope this doesn't happen to you, but every once in a while, I'll be driving down this road, and I'll see somebody sitting out there with a sign, and Satan comes in through my mind and says, God, there's another guy ripping people off. He probably lives in a really nice house. He probably has a great car around the corner. I never saw Jesus do that. Not once. Not once. He didn't check and make sure the leprosy was really leprosy. You know, when he talked to the woman at the well, not only did people not talk to women back then, but people also Jews never talked to somebody that wasn't a Jew. And yet he did anyway. He gave her worth that day. He gave her hope that day. And I really believe that that's one of the reasons we're here in Wichita Falls right now, is to give people hope. You know, we have to offer them the greatest gift you could ever give them. You know, some people think, well, if you gave somebody $1 million, that'd be the greatest gift. $1 million doesn't come within, it doesn't even start the value of what we have to give. We have a lifeline. We have hope. Do you know how many people in the world right now are living out there without hope? All they need is somebody to love them. All they need is somebody to care about them. And in love, sometimes to tell them what you're doing right now is going to lead you to destruction, both physically and spiritually. Sometimes Christian love can be tough. But given the right way, it's taken well. What does Jesus say to the woman caught in adultery? Do this again and you're going to hell? Don't do it anymore. I started to get that feeling from his words. He's saying, you're better than this. You were meant for something more than this. You were meant to be with God. So he befriended the friendless. I was reading an article the other day, and it just, what I read, I mean, it just really hit me. There's a guy, there's a soccer player, supposed to be one of the best soccer players in the world. His name is Sadio Mane, I believe. I don't know how to pronounce it. Anyway, he makes $14 million a year. Okay, he's from Senegal, grew up in a very poor lifestyle. And people started noticing after he got his big contract that he wasn't doing the same thing everybody else was doing. He wasn't buying the multiple cars and the big mansions and flashy rings and dying. He wasn't doing any of that. And they wanted to know why. So I saw an interview, he said this. He said, why would I want 10 Ferraris, 20 diamond watches, 2 airplanes? What will these objects do for me or for the world? And then he told his story. He said, I was hungry. I had no food. And I worked all day. They wouldn't let me go to school. And I worked my way through that. And the only place I had to play football was out, or soccer was out on a dirt, rocky, but he played in his spare time. And he said, I finally got good enough where people wanted to pay me to play. No education, no family name to live off of. But I know that from today, from what I get, I can help people that were like me. And so this gentleman, and it's pretty impressive what he's done, he's built schools in Senegal. He's built gyms in Senegal. He buys clothes and shoes and food for people he sees in the streets there. Because he doesn't spend his off season in London or in Paris or in the United States like a lot of the other players do. He is there trying to find people that need help in Senegal. And he's even gone to the point of, he picked out one section of Senegal, the poorest, poorest section. And he gives every family in that section 70 euros a month to try to raise them up to where they can live comfortable lifestyles. It's a pretty incredible guy. And I would love to tell you it's because he's a Christian. But it's not. He's Muslim. He's Muslim. But he knows enough of Christian value, he knows enough of being blessed, that he's supposed to share it with other people, and he does that. Sometimes the love that we're going to show is going to cost us something. Sometimes we're going to have to give up something we want. Sometimes we're going to have to lower ourselves lower than what we think we should be to talk to somebody. Maybe we have to go to an area we're uncomfortable with the type of people that are there. And yet that's where we're being called to go. Back earlier in the 19th century, there was a Catholic priest, teacher, and theologian named Henry Nouwen. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. Henry Nouwen had made a big name for himself. He was teaching at, he had taught at Notre Dame. He had been at the Harvard Divinity School of Divinity, the Yale School of Divinity, and he was miserable. He was writing books. They were selling. He was miserable. He didn't feel like he was doing anything for God. And then one day somebody shared with him that there was a group in Canada, I think it's in Quebec, who had started something called the Le Arche Daybreak Community, which is a place for people to go to who had severe birth problems, cerebral palsy, possibly cancer, things that were just devastating their bodies, people that could not take care of themselves. And he visited the first time for a few days. And he knew that when he left there, he was burdened with what he had seen, the people that were struggling to survive and the people that were taking care of them, who were all believers. And he knew that he wanted to go back. But he didn't just want to go back for 10 days. He quit his job. And the last 10 years of his life, Henry Nguyen, this renowned professor, writer, washed one particular guy's body every day. There was a gentleman there that had severe cerebral palsy, could not do anything for himself. And you can imagine, that's a tough job. Some of you have done that for family members. It's hard. But he was doing it for a man that wasn't part of his physical family, but who he saw as part of God's family. Guys, we can make a difference in this town if we decide we want to get out there and show God's love. And I'm going to give you some examples. Today, some of you can go to lunch. Right? And you can go to a restaurant, and maybe you're not going to get the best waitress in the world. Maybe she's training. Maybe she shouldn't have ever started being a waitress, but that's where she's at. And you have an option. You can treat her nice. You can say nice things. You can compliment her on the things she does well. And maybe even leave some tip, even if it's not, if she didn't deserve a great tip. You can ask her about her family. You can make her know when you leave that restaurant that you felt valued to be in her presence today. And you can do that everywhere you go. In Christian love, we need to make it our goal to make every person's day a day where they know they're loved. Where it doesn't matter what color their skin is. It doesn't matter what gender they are. It doesn't even matter what political party they follow. I said it. It doesn't matter. They're God's creation. And if you find yourself with a group of people that are telling you somebody's not lovable or somebody should be hated, know that those people that you are with are not of God. They're not of God. God calls us to love, and he gave us the greatest example when we were allowed through the Gospels to see the life of his son. And if you're not... One more confession. I need to be reading the Gospels every single day, along with other parts of the Bible. But I need to be looking at Jesus' example and see what he did. And notice that he was never critical of the people that he was around, unless he was trying to teach like the Pharisees that what they were doing was wrong. He never condemned. In fact, he said he didn't come to condemn. He came to seek and save the lost. So I'm going to ask you today, when we leave here, and I'm about finished, but when we leave here today, I want you to do something for me. Number one, and we should do this every week, is to trust God. Everything that he says in his word is true, and what he's asking you to do, you do. But I'm also going to ask you to love like Jesus. And that means if you got comfort zones, get rid of them. If you're uncomfortable around, let's say, homeless people, come down here on Thursday and start meeting some homeless people. If you have problems because of the way you were raised with a particular nationality of people, you go find some people of that nationality and you get to learn to know them and love them. If you've been raised and your parents taught you to hate certain groups of people, I love your parents. They were probably very good people, but what they taught you was wrong. Our job is to love. And that's the only way we're going to make a difference in the world. There's so many conflicting messages out there today. I watch 13-year-olds every day who have no idea where they're headed. Because somebody's telling them, this is right, and this is right, and this is right. But you know what they do know? They do know I love them. They do know I'll take care of them if something happens. And some of them that I've had a little bit better chance to talk to know exactly what I believe is going to happen one day when this world ends or when they die. Love people enough to share. 1 John 3:16 says, this is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. And let's use the connotation of our brothers being all mankind. Be willing to love today. Be willing to love this week. And I can promise you, if we'll do that, we're going to fill this place up and we're going to be back in the auditorium because we won't be able to handle everybody in here. Follow God today. Trust Him and love like Jesus.